The failure of drug war is glaringly obvious to judges, cops, wardens, prosecutors, and millions more now calling for decriminalization, legalization, the end of prohibition. Let us investigate the century of lies.
Hello, and welcome to Century of Lies. I'm your host, Doug McVeigh. Claire Zagorski is a harm reduction activist, paramedic, graduate research assistant in translational science at the University of Texas College of Pharmacy, and adjunct faculty at the Pharmacotherapy Education and Research Center at UT Health Science Center at San Antonio. We heard part one of that conversation a couple weeks ago. Now here's part two. Let's talk about some of the other stuff you're involved with. Could you do some good stuff? Tell me about the Austin Harm Reduction Coalition.
Yeah, so Austin Harm Reduction Coalition is no more, but it isn't. So it was absorbed into Vivant Health, which is a small nonprofit chain, and they run and facilitate AID services of Austin as well. And so they now run the syringe exchange in Austin. So the guts are still there; it just has a different name. But yeah, that's where I got started in harm reduction. They, you know, allowed my very naive self to come on and, you know, listen and learn and absorb and do some work. And when I finished paramedic school, they transitioned me to do wound care, which was a huge need, still is even more of a need now. And they really introduced me and mentored me into harm reduction. So incredibly fond of that org. And, you know, I'm glad that there's something still ongoing. Since AHRC has become Vivant, and the program is called LifePoint, but we've also had another organization open in Texas, Texas Harm Reduction Alliance, which is a newer one. And they also do service here in Austin, but their more specific focus is that they're working on building coalitions around Texas, and working to kind of get us all on the same page and working together to really elevate the message, but also to get more done in the state. A lot of what we aren't able to do in Texas boils down to state law, and changing that is a pretty Herculean effort. But it's really not going to happen if we can't work together. So, yeah, they are in place to get that going and to get more people on board with harm reduction across the state, not just in the metro areas.
Well, now, so Texas Harm Reduction, Texas, say the name?
Texas Harm Reduction Alliance.
Texas Harm Reduction Alliance. Hmm. Because that's, well, that's one of the things I'm interested in. I was interested in talking with you about. I reside here in Portland, Oregon. It's a lovely place. I was just out picking berries during lunch, and
that's lovely.
Oh, it is, and it's also rather blue, as its politics go, and even here, harm reduction is one of the oldest syringe service programs in the country, legal syringe service programs in the country.
Yeah, that's awesome.
But now Texas is somewhat different culturally and politically, and I'm kind of wondering, how do you advance harm reduction in a conservative state? I mean, things like syringe service programs, naloxone availability. How is it done in a place like Texas?
Very incrementally. So it just really depends on who you're talking to. And probably the best single thing that you can do is to find a champion. So if there's like one person within maybe state legislature who listens to you and believes in you, that goes a really long way. So for example, in Texas, syringe exchange is not legal except for one program that was set aside as like an exception pilot program by the legislature a few years ago. And that's in Bexar County, which is San Antonio. And so this was basically, well, okay, let's see how this goes, was their approach to this. And that happened because of Ruth Ann McClendon, who is now retired, was a Texas legislator for many years. And without that champion, I don't know that that would have ever been seriously considered. So a lot of it is tedious work. It's a lot about relationship building, going to individuals and small groups and figuring out what punches their buttons. What are they caring about? Maybe, you know, what is impacting that person's constituency? Or does this organization have a particular interest in some component of the larger picture here? So, for example, we have, you know, we're a very red state. We have a lot of conservatives that we have to sway. And harm reduction is just to them very symbolically and philosophically against what they're doing, even if they don't look more carefully into the details of what we're doing. Just the general idea sounds wrong, and it also sounds like something that their constituents aren't going to understand. So that's kind of the general context that we come in. So if I go, and I did this in our last legislative session, to go testify in support of syringe access program legalization, then I'm probably not going to talk to the red conservative rural legislators about social justice, but I will take that opportunity to talk to them about how syringe access programs take a big bite out of hepatitis C rates, which is something impacting boomers, as well as people who use drugs for different reasons, but I don't mention that. Or you can talk about how a lot of money will be saved if we can prevent excess, you know, for, to use a stat term, excess overdoses. We can bring down the level, how much money we will save per person. If we can bring down skin and soft tissue infections associated with dirty needle use or used needles, how much money will be saved? So sometimes you have to figure out kind of a fiscal argument. Having said that, though, there's also a good argument to be made that if you focus on things like saving money, that is kind of a betrayal of the ideals of harm reduction if you are willing to kind of not talk about social justice or not talk about racist policing. That, you know, why won't we talk about that, and what are we giving up by not talking about that? So this is never an easy thing to figure out. I wish I had the answer for how to do this perfectly in rural areas or in conservative states. But it's something that we're constantly learning more about. Like just last year, I and several of my colleagues spent a lot of time really sitting and talking and thinking about how different parts of Texas, which is a very big state, have dramatically different contexts when approaching this. If we're in Austin, for example, or Dallas or Houston, like a big city, you know, there's a lot of social programs around. Maybe you can rely on a street outreach team made up of physicians and social workers. Maybe you can contact, you know, a church outreach group. Like there's so many different options. They may be small and disjointed, but they're there. If you go to a rural community in the valley that is mostly farming and ranching, well, if someone experiences an overdose or is at risk of an overdose, there's really no one else there but probably a sheriff. So what does that mean if we have to participate with a law enforcement officer in this overall goal, or do we not? What do we give up by not? What do we give up by doing? Where are we now versus where should we be if we keep working? And how do we reconcile that with maintaining the ideals of harm reduction versus addressing the problem that's in front of us right now? So it's really hard. And yeah, I don't know kind of what else to say. I just try to kind of address the problem in front of me and do as much as I can to get incremental gains, especially with laws and getting bills through as best as we can, and trying to bit by bit get people to see the bigger, more complex picture that is not always easy to grasp, especially if your initial reaction is negative.
No, I can see what you mean. I mean, on the other hand, risk management is smart, and it's also very cost effective, and you know, at a really basic kind of common sense level, leaving aside philosophies and political viewpoints, just a very basic common sense level, risk management is smart, and it's also cost effective. And ultimately, that's what harm reduction programs accomplish at some levels, is you're managing the risk, back in the early days when harm reduction when the syringe service programs were first being introduced, the people in the UK were actually using the phrase risk minimization. Risk minimization is too many syllables for Americans, so harm reduction. Plus also there's the very pragmatic question of whether the idea of minimizing risk sounds worse than reducing harm. And, you know, it's minimizing risk. Well, minimizing, what do you mean? Whereas reducing the harms, okay, well, you know, not having people get hurt, that makes sense. That's easier. That sounds like an easier sell. But in some respects, I think that I can kind of see the point. And there are any number of people, I don't care what your politics are, they may be less concerned about philosophical purity and more concerned with what do these things actually do, and how does it, and what, mm-hmm. you know, and, you know, well, they manage the risk. Okay. Well, that makes sense. I mean, I don't know of any farmer who would disagree with the need to minimize risk to manage risk. It's tough to minimize them, but you can at least manage them. Yeah. No, I mean, I don't envy you the difficult. It's hard enough doing that up here in a place in a place that's on the other side politically.
I think probably the best single bit of advice that I have on that is to remember who matters in the discussion. So if I'm ever in a point where I'm just like, well, I don't really know, what do people who use drugs in Texas want? What do they need right now? Because, you know, I try to remember that I have a fairly public position relative to a lot of the folks that I work with. I have a lot of privilege. And so it matters much less what I personally think and much more what I can elevate and communicate from people that are very easy to ignore in Texas. So sometimes, I can see a philosophical conflict, but the people that I serve and work with want action right now. And they're willing to sacrifice something to stop the bleeding of the deaths that we have. So I feel like that's constantly shifting. Every issue is slightly different. Every few months, there's something slightly different. But that's why I think that really keeping in mind what people who use drugs want and need really has to be first and foremost. So staying connected with that community and not becoming just a purely philosophical thinker, but actually seeing what's out there and what's happening in real time is really important in this space.
This is my conversation with Claire Zagorski. We'll have more in a moment. You're listening to Century of Lies. I'm your host, Doug McVeigh. Let's continue with harm reduction in Texas. You recently wrote a piece in the Austin Chronicle about the need for overdose prevention centers, places where people basically don't die. If they end up where they can have their lives saved, should they accidentally mm-hmm. overdose? Tell me about overdose prevention. What do you think about OPCs tell me about OPCs.
Yeah. So like you said, it's a quite simple idea that it's a place where you can go use substances and hopefully not die. And I put in hopefully because I like to mitigate some of the language that we use. A colleague of ours, Corey Davis, who's a public health attorney, pointed out on Twitter recently, I think this is a super salient point, that while it's really enticing to tell people, you know, there hasn't been a single death in an OPC ever, and that's true, but that also kind of sets us up for unrealistic expectations because, you know, look at hospitals. Hospitals are awesome. They sure can be. They're where you go to if you know your life is in danger, but people die there all the time. It's just part of life. People die. At any rate, apologies for that tangent, but you know, there are places where you can use a substance, and if an overdose occurs, someone is there immediately with naloxone to bring you back. So you're not, you know, by yourself where you may not get help in time, or if you do, maybe you are without oxygen for a long time and it has harmed your brain. And there are also places where, you know, you have a sharps container right there to dispose of a syringe that you may have used, and to throw away anything else that you use to prepare your shot. And note that I'm talking about injectables. That's the most predominant model at this point, is for people who inject, although there's a lot to say about spaces for people that smoke or vape. But yeah, and they're just really simple setups. And, you know, they exist in a few places around the world. And it's really, you know, you'll pull up to a little booth almost, and the equipment that you need will be there. A sharps container will be there. There will be a mirror probably facing you just to help you kind of see what you're doing. And if anything goes wrong, someone will be there right away. And they're simple and straightforward. They are staffed usually with maybe a couple of nurses or EMTs, but mostly it's people that have experience with using naloxone and experience with using drugs that know what they're doing and want to help. So it's a really beautiful way to kind of organize the community together to organically help prevent death and, you know, empower people to use substances in a space that's clean and supervised, and, you know, they don't have to fear, you know, having to hide from people or having to fear the police. But they're an awfully hard sell. Especially in places like Texas. one of the major reasons why I wrote that op-ed is that for a lot of people here, that's not something they've seriously thought about. So I wanted to really lay out the argument for them. I also know, you know, some of our public leaders have mentioned to me privately that they really like the idea of an OPC in Austin, but they don't think there's a critical mass of public support. And since they're elected, they have to kind of choose their battles. And, you know, there's something to be said about that, but I get it. They work on an election basis, so maybe I can help them out. Maybe we can start this conversation. So, you know, I don't really expect major substantial shifts from that one OPC. It's going to be way harder than that. But if I can get some folks to think about it and to consider the potential benefits of it, which are pretty significant, then, you know, all the better. Because we recently declared a public health emergency on overdoses locally in Travis County, which is the county that we're in. We had the highest rates of confirmed overdoses, that is, in Austin that we've ever had. And there are plenty of people who I'm sure die and their deaths do not end up getting classified as an overdose for lots of reasons. And, it also, overdose death also surpassed things like car crashes and falls as a leading cause of death for the first time, I think, ever. So, yeah, we've had a lot of people die needlessly. And there's also been a lot of angst as Austin has only grown and become more and more gentrified about, you know, people are using drugs downtown publicly. We can see them do it. It's just horrible. And a lot of angst about things like syringe litter. So, you know, if you're coming at it from that direction, if you don't want to see people use drugs, well, then you should support something like an OPC, because they will literally go into a building to use drugs. And you won't see them do it unless you're in there as well. So I wish that everyone had a compassion first view of this, but they don't. So if I can get some maybe downtown business owners to think of it pragmatically, great. But it's just the easiest slam dunk from a public health standpoint. Like, yes. It would be inexpensive and have huge returns in a lot of different domains.
Not just overdose, there's also the other services. I mean, they operate as a syringe service program, so bloodborne diseases, mm-hmm. as you were saying, the ones that allow smoking. You've got, because you've still got hepatitis C concerns, whether it's crack or methamphetamine, people are smoking in a way. I have a tough time with stating this, because I don't want to stigmatize people based on how they use whatever. And it's just that when you do inject, you're kind of opening up a hole in your skin. And there's all mm-hmm. kinds of ways that an infection can happen with that, where you don't have quite that same sort of risk when you're smoking. So in terms of methamphetamine, mm-hmm. people can, or cocaine, people can certainly inject. They can also smoke it or sniff it. And if they have the equipment safe, a safe smoking kit, for instance, then they mm-hmm. don't risk sharing. They don't have hepatitis C. There's so much use. And you mentioned the in harm reduction. You got put onto wound care because you're a trained paramedic, and I suppose that's another advantage of a thing like an overdose prevention center, where there's people. I mean, once you build up trust, you can, you know, it's like, hey, I see you got a thing on you. It looks like an abscess on your arm. Here, let me take care of that. That kind of thing. That's mm-hmm. that is a real problem, right? That's not just.
Yeah, it's been especially bad lately, as we've seen xylazine entering the drug supply. But it's and like skin and soft tissue infections have always been an issue. It's especially compounded. And this tends to be pretty regional, but here in Austin, we also have a law against euphemistically called outdoor camping. So really, it's a law against being visibly homeless. But we don't have adequate housing. We don't have adequate affordable housing. We don't have adequate shelters, even though there's plenty of issues with shelters. But all that being said, it really just boils down to us, you know, sending the police out to shuffle around unhoused people every few days. And all that being said, for unhoused people who also use substances, they aren't able to take care of wounds. They aren't able to access consistent running water. They aren't able to keep their skin and their equipment clean. So, you know, wounds getting infected has always been a problem. It's especially bad now as the drug supply has shifted. And I'm sure it's going to, you know, shift in some other horrible way in the future. we can definitely learn from the past and know that will come again.
I talked about the political and cultural differences between Texas and Oregon, Portland and Austin. And we're not that much different. That is how a lot of what's happening in Portland with people who are unhoused and a lot, and that's pretty much and that's exactly how we're treating them here with camping bans yeah. and moving people on and trying to just
yeah. I was talking to a colleague yesterday about this, and we were talking about longitudinal wound care, because the thing with wounds that's especially difficult to manage is that you don't just do one treatment and they're gone. Like, you have to tend to them often over several weeks. And, you know, saying like at this point, like, we have a couple of different people that kind of can contact folks. And I'm like, if we can contact someone three times before we lose them, we're doing pretty well. Because so few people have consistent phones And so if they're moved repeatedly and repeatedly, they're going into like maybe brushy or wooded areas just to try to avoid detection. Well, they're avoiding police detection, but they're also avoiding, inadvertently avoiding our detection. So these folks are just getting sicker and less resourced. And we're basically comfortable just kind of brushing things under the rug. And those things in this context is literal human beings. So it's very disheartening. But in the context of, injection-related wounds, it's especially rough. We're getting to a point where, well, we have been, or we're getting to a point where, probably 25 cents worth of a clean syringe and alcohol and is being rejected in favor of either letting people eventually die or putting them in a county hospital for a multi-hundred-thousand-dollar amputation surgery plus physical therapy after, their foot basically rots away. And it's the most foolish decision, and it's heartless. It's very expensive. It's straining a lot of resources. And I'm sad to say that it seems to continue basically as a symbolic measure. Because it's for lots of reasons that I could probably talk about for the rest of the day. But it's frustrating. But I think the worst thing would be giving up and not trying. So that's why I kind of keep butting my head against the wall for that.
Well, you've got to. Somebody's got to speak up.
Yeah.
You got to start the conversation. Yeah. Remind people that we're all people. Use drugs or not, and most people use drugs of some kind, and then we can go on with the rest of it. Yeah.
I think that's a really good point too. Something to remind people is that there's so many people who use drugs but have money and have housing, and they never face punishment. Those people are very often white. One of the things that I suggested at one point, because we're trying to get fentanyl test strips moved off of the paraphernalia law, because they're currently considered drug paraphernalia. And if we can't decriminalize paraphernalia writ large, which we've tried, well, can we at least get FTSs moved off of that? One of the things I kind of half seriously pointed out was like, well, tell the legislators that their sons and their colleagues' sons in college who are smoking, or not smoking, but that are snorting cocaine, really need to test their cocaine because fentanyl is in the cocaine now. But those are the kind of people, like these very privileged people, that use substances and never face ramifications for it. But, if someone living on the street uses the same drug, they're very likely to have devastating health effects, be arrested, have a charge on their record that prevents them from getting housing and jobs and opportunities down the road. So it's tremendously unfair. So thank you for mentioning that.
That was my conversation with Claire Zagorski. She's a harm reduction activist, paramedic, graduate research assistant in translational science at the University of Texas College of Pharmacy, and adjunct faculty at the Pharmacotherapy Education and Research Center at UT Health Science Center at San Antonio.
For the Drug Truth Network, this is Doug McVeigh asking you to examine our policy of drug prohibition, the Century of Lies. Drug Truth Network programs archived at the James A. Baker III Institute for Public Policy.